Picture a CEO so confident in his invincibility that he decides to buy his own company and triggers the greatest corporate battle in American history. In October 1988, Ross Johnson, the flamboyant head of RJR Nabisco, casually announced his plan to take the company private for $17.6 billion. What seemed like a done deal exploded into a six-week war that would captivate Wall Street, shock the public, and forever change how we think about corporate power. The fight pitted Johnson's lavish management team against Henry Kravis, the quiet architect of the leveraged buyout revolution. By the time the dust settled, the price had soared to $25 billion, the largest corporate takeover ever attempted. This wasn't just a business transaction. It was a morality play about greed, ambition, and the corrosive effects of unchecked power, set against the backdrop of 1980s excess. The story became so iconic that barbarians at the gate entered the lexicon as shorthand for corporate raiders, and the tale remains required reading in business schools as a cautionary lesson about what happens when personal ambition collides with fiduciary duty. Ross Johnson didn't climb the corporate ladder, he bulldozed it. The Canadian-born executive embodied 1980s excess, irreverent, profane, and convinced rules didn't apply to him. His philosophy? The chief executive can do whatever he wants. At Standard Brands, Johnson assembled loyal merrymen and orchestrated a boardroom coup, transforming the company into Phi Delta Johnson, replacing frugality with corporate jets, profanity-laced meetings, and country club memberships. He quadrupled his salary and hired sports celebrities like Frank Gifford for promotional work that resembled personal entertainment. Beneath the charm lurked ruthlessness. Johnson fired executives without remorse while protecting friends who billed personal expenses to the company. His product innovations flopped spectacularly. Smooth and Easy gravy bars and the Reggie candy bar failed miserably. When profits sagged, he reorganized constantly, shuffling jobs twice yearly under the guise of fighting specialization. His real talent wasn't building businesses. It was engineering mergers that propelled him upward, combining Standard Brands with Nabisco, then orchestrating Nabisco's merger with tobacco giant R.J. Reynolds. Nabisco's wholesome cookie bakers and Reynolds tobacco executives created corporate America's most awkward marriage. Nabisco was a sleepy giant that venerated past glories, where no one worked past five. Reynolds was Winston-Salem's lifeblood, so deeply woven into the community that on humid days, tobacco's smell hung over downtown. Richard Joshua Reynolds built more than a business. He built a culture. The 6'2" Virginian rode into Winston-Salem in 1874 and established a factory embodying New South entrepreneurialism. When he introduced Camel cigarettes in 1913 at 20 for a dime, the brand sold 425 million packs within a year. He created anticipation stock, giving workers voting power, and paid 10% of profits above $2.2 million, turning dividend payments into local holidays. This paternalistic culture survived until the 1970s, when Philip Morris's Marlboro overtook Winston. CEO Ty Lee Wilson Solution acquired Nabisco for $4.9 billion in 1985. The culture clash was immediate. Reynolds executives recoiled at Nabisco's white limousines, while Nabisco's bakers balked at joining death merchants. Johnson called it Mom and Apple Pie Meet the Skull and Crossbones. Within 3 years as CEO, Johnson had purged Reynolds veterans, moved headquarters to Atlanta, and reshaped the company, setting the stage for his audacious buyout attempt. While Johnson built his empire of excess, Henry Kravis quietly revolutionized how businesses changed hands. Born to wealth in Tulsa, Kravis rose through leveraged buyouts, using borrowed money to buy companies, then selling them at higher prices. By 1988, his firm controlled businesses that would collectively rank among America's top 10 corporations, with $45 billion in buying power. Kravis learned LBOs from Jerome Kohlberg at Bear Stearns. These bootstrap deals began as elegant solutions for aging founders. Form a shell company backed by investors to buy businesses using mostly borrowed money. Let original owners retain stakes, then sell shares to the public at higher prices. When Bear Stearns' trading culture clashed with their buyout business, Kohlberg, Kravis, and cousin George Roberts established KKR in 1976. For 5 years, they followed Kohlberg's principles: friendly deals, management participation, careful execution. Their obscurity ended in 1982 when William Simon's Gibson Greetings deal turned $330,000 into $66 million. Michael Milken's junk bonds transformed LBOs into aggressive takeover tools. Kohlberg grew uncomfortable and departed in 1987. Kravis then deliberately targeted mega deals, $5 to $10 billion buyouts few others could attempt. By 1987, they'd raised a record $5.6 billion fund, controlling $1 of every $4 in global LBO equity. By 1988, Johnson faced a crisis. RJR Nabisco stock languished in the low 40s despite strong profits. The market treated it as a tobacco stock, ignoring that 60% of sales came from food. After a $1.1 billion buyback failed, Johnson grew receptive to dramatic solutions. Investment bankers circled with LBO proposals. When Johnson worried about the enormous sum required, Peter Cohen from Shearson Lehman Hutton confidently replied, "Yeah, we can do it." Johnson's approach was unconventional. Rather than secretly arranging financing, he proposed the LBO as an idea for board consideration. At $75 per share, nearly $17.6 billion, it would be almost three times larger than any previous LBO. Johnson demanded unprecedented management control and 20% of company stock, potentially worth $2.5 billion. On October 19, 1988, Johnson presented his proposal. When the announcement hit the next morning, chaos erupted. Henry Kravis was stunned. RJR going private at 75 a share? I can't believe this. We gave them the idea. The largest corporate takeover in history had begun. The announcement electrified Wall Street. Kravis submitted an unsolicited tender offer of $90 per share, $21 billion. Johnson was devastated, believing no competitor could top his bid without management's cooperation. Peter Cohen refused to quit. Noticing Kravis's bid wasn't entirely cash, Johnson's team countered with $100 per share, $23 billion, swamping Kravis's revised $94 bid. The special committee prepared to declare Johnson the winner until First Boston proposed a restructuring worth $105 to $118 per share, forcing a 10-day extension. Johnson's reputation took a beating from a Time magazine cover story titled "A Game of Greed" that quoted him calling his potential $100 million payout monopoly money. In the final hours, Cohen boosted their bid to $112 per share, requiring Johnson to slash the management stake from 8.5% to just 4%. Johnson, reduced to helpless giggles, agreed. "But if we go any further, we're going to be owing them money." Kravis countered with $109 per share and a 30-minute deadline. The directors voted unanimously for Kravis. Johnson responded with resigned acceptance. "Surprise, let's get together and see the guys." On February 9, 1989, $18.9 billion changed hands in a single morning, funding so massive it temporarily bulged U.S. money supply statistics. By 10:45, RJR Nabisco belonged to KKR. Johnson departed with his $53 million golden parachute, flying to Florida on his new Gulfstream. In Winston-Salem, nearly $2 billion in checks created a community of reluctant millionaires who couldn't bear parting with their shares. Kravis recruited Louis Gerstner from American Express as CEO. Gerstner dismantled Johnson's empire, selling 7 of 8 corporate jets and numerous properties. Despite a $1.15 billion loss in 1989 after debt payments, cash flow remained strong. The deal both defined and ended an era. By 1990, the junk bond market collapsed, bringing down Drexel Burnham Lambert. Public opinion turned against Wall Street after insider trading scandals. Ironically, CEOs learned the barbarian's lessons. Build wealth through equity ownership and stock options without doing any LBO. This led to compensation that made Johnson's $53 million seem modest. The battle revealed enduring truths: the tension between shareholder value and corporate stewardship, the corrupting influence of excessive compensation, and the dangers of financial engineering divorced from business realities. The barbarians hadn't just stormed the gate, they'd fundamentally changed the game.